Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live, Saturdays from 9 to noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM in BC, Canada. For more information, check out www.vcn.bc.ca/redeye. Here's Jane Williams.
Here in Canada, we've heard Oslo, Oslo, Oslo for the last 7 years. That was the mantra that opened and closed almost every news report from Israel and occupied Palestine. For Palestinians, the last 7 years were far more than shuttle diplomacy and news conferences, but their lives and experiences have been hidden from our view. In the studio to discuss the view from the ground are Salim Shawamre and Jeff Halper. Salim is a Palestinian whose home has been demolished twice by Israeli authorities. Jeff Halper is the coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, and both are in Vancouver today as part of their Cross North America speaking tour. Welcome to Co-op Radio, Jeff.
Thank you.
And Salim.
Thank you.
Now, Salim, your house was demolished by the Israeli government when your family was actually living in it. What reason did they give you for that?
You know, Israeli authorities not giving Palestinians permits, and that's a policy which is going on since 1967. And when I tried to get a permit from 1990 until 1994, 4 years, I applied 3 times to get permit, but all the time they refused to give us permits as Palestinians. One of the reasons that they gave me not to give me permit because my land has a big slope. Everybody knows that Jerusalem is located on mountains, and every mountain should have a slope. But it's only reasons given to us not to give us permits. And another reason, in the second time when I applied, they told me that I missed 2 signatures of the ownership of the land. While when I bought the land, I stamped it from Interior Ministry, I stamped it from an Israeli lawyer, I stamped it from Civil Administration Office itself. And it's legal, and there is no problems in the ownership. But when I applied to get a permit to build on that piece of land, so it is illegal.
When did you build?
I started building my home in 1994, living inside with my family until the black date in our life, which is 9th of July 1998, when we are sitting to take our lunch. I heard a big voice outside the home, so I get out to see what's that. I see my home surrounded by soldiers and all the nearby area. More than 200 soldiers with a bulldozer coming to destroy my home because it is illegal.
And no warning?
No warning. It's suddenly. Suddenly, we are eating, so I see that my home surrounded by soldiers. Given 15 minutes to take my belongings and family out because they want to destroy it. And when I refused to get out of my home, so they start beating me and kicking me on my head, on my back, until I lost my consciousness. And my family, because they didn't want to get out of the home, they start breaking the windows, throwing inside the tear gas to force my 6 kids and my wife to get out of the home. My wife also lost her consciousness that day, and my kids screaming and crying, and I'm freezing to the ground, can't do anything.
So then everybody comes out and they just go in with a bulldozer?
Yes. They force us to get out, and the bulldozers start destroying our home. Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition that day, they came and cheer us. To help us not to let our home destroyed, but also Jeff Halper, the head of the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition, beat it as I beat also. And they arrest him and put him on the side of behind me.
And what has been the effect on your wife and on your children as a result of this demolition?
You know, destroying home is bad, but destroying the families which they are living inside is the worst thing in this situation. You know, my wife for 2 months didn't talk. I sent her to Jordan for a physical treatment. And my kids, they are not, in school they are very good before the demolition, but now they get very, very much back, 50 to 60, their marks in school. And my smallest 2 kids, until now, they are afraid to go from the bathroom from their bedroom to the bathroom in the night until my wife took them by her hand. And my oldest boy, he's 16 years old, he left the school to help the family in its new situation. Just before 2 months, you don't believe that, there is a helicopter going over our home to shoot the Palestinians' police offices. So my smallest two kids, they can't stand on their legs. They fall down, and they have a very pain in their stomach. Then I try to make it easy to them. I'm with you, I'll protect you. Don't believe that. My smallest daughter, she is 9 years old, she told me, no, you can't protect us. We saw what happened when the soldiers came and destroyed our home. They kick you and beat you and put you on the side. Imagine that your daughter telling you that you can't protect her. This is like a knife going to the heart of the man, of any man in the world, I think.
Jeff, your committee to oppose house demolitions helped Salim rebuild his home after that, but the Israeli government destroyed it again. How many Palestinian homes has Israel demolished since it occupied the West Bank and Gaza in 67?
Since 1967, Israel's demolished about 7,000 Palestinian homes. And these are not homes of terrorists. These are homes that are demolished for all kinds of reasons. Homes in refugee camps that are demolished in order to make wide alleyways. In Gaza, they're called Sharon alleyways because Sharon himself ordered the demolition of about 2,000 homes in the refugee camps to make it easier for Israeli military vehicles to circulate through the camps. Whole villages were demolished after 1967. And in general, the policy of land demolitions over the last about 20 years has been in order to confine Palestinians to little islands on the West Bank and in Gaza and in East Jerusalem, in order to leave the vast majority of the occupied territories free for Israeli settlements and roads and military control. Today, there are about 4,000 demolition orders outstanding in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. New demolition orders are issued all the time by the civil administration, which is the Israeli military government in the occupied territories or the Jerusalem municipality, if we're talking about East Jerusalem, so that there are 4,000 families today that are waiting that any day, like happened with Salim, any day, any moment, the bulldozer can come and demolish their homes.
So since Oslo, this has been continuing at the same rate, and since the Intifada, it's been continuing?
Well, since Oslo, it's actually been, the tempo's been increased. And I think what you said at the very beginning in your opening remarks is one of our central messages, that the occupation has become hidden, has disappeared over the course of the last 7 years because everybody's been so focused on the peace process. And the peace process has its own dynamics and its own agenda and everything. It became more and more remote from what was happening on the ground. But people lost sight of what was happening on the ground, which was, in fact, the occupation only got stronger. And the Israeli presence, on the one hand, and the Israeli repression, on the other hand, got ever more strong. So that the policies of house demolitions have even increased in recent years. Although I have to say that, you know, when our committee began working about 4 or 5 years ago, it was really a painful kind of a thing. And over the last couple of years, we have managed to get the numbers down. The problem is that we didn't change the policy. And so, first of all, in the Intifada, the last few months, about 500 houses have been demolished. So Israel, in a sense, kind of cleared the table. And since the policy hasn't been changed, we have every reason to expect that under Sharon, the house demolition policy will be renewed.
Now, house demolitions are just one element of right. I believe, what you describe as an entire matrix of control over the occupied territories. Can you talk a little bit about that matrix of control?
Well, the matrix of control was already instituted after 67, and especially after 81, when Israel established what it called the civil administration in order to lower its military profile. Because Israel does not want the world to see an occupation. He wants to see a kind of a bureaucratic administration of territories and so on. But in fact, this matrix control is all-encompassing. It almost suffocates Palestinians. It's a whole web of dependency and control that's been set over their lives. House demolitions is one thing. Everything a Palestinian needs from the morning till night, you need permits for. You know, going to school, getting a car, getting a driver's license, building a house, buying land, the ability to go to work, coming to Israel and go to work. There's a whole system of dependency and control that's been set up in that way. At the same time, you have the doubling of the settlements since Oslo was signed in 1997. The settlement population stands at about 200,000 on the West Bank today, which is twice as much as when Oslo was signed. You have a closure over the occupied territories, the West Bank and Gaza, you know, so that Palestinian workers cannot come into Israel to work after they had been turned into a dependent and cheap source of labor in the Israeli economy, which means that the Palestinian workforce since 1993 has become impoverished. Today, the average Palestinian family earns about one-third of what it made when the Oslo peace accords were signed. So it's been a disaster from that point of view. You have tens of thousands of acres of land that have been expropriated for settlements, for roads. You have a massive road system, what Israel calls a bypass road system, to both connect up the settlements and also to become barriers, in a sense, to Palestinian movement that's been laid over the West Bank since 1993. You know, increased military control, certainly, so that you really have a situation where today the Israeli presence is much more massive in the West Bank. The control is much more massive than it was in 1993. So what we're trying to say basically is, if you look at the peace process, it sounds like peace. It sounds like Israel wants peace, and you know, Barak has made the offer of 90-95%, which sounds good. But if you look at what's happening on the ground, an entirely different picture emerges, and that is that Israel has massively invested in keeping its presence permanent, in expanding its presence in the occupied territories, and there is no sign whatsoever that Israel is prepared to meaningfully withdraw. A Palestinian state would probably emerge, because Israel doesn't want to give citizenship to the 3 million Palestinians. But in a sense, Israel is looking for what we call an occupation by consent, a kind of a mini-state, all controlled by Israel, carved up into little tiny islands. So it's true, you know, the Palestinians might get 90 or 95% of the territory, but Israel only. But the real question is, what's the meaning of the other 5 to 10%? And what we're claiming is that all Israel needs is the other 5 or so percent in order to maintain the control and to turn that Palestinian state into a virtual Bantu state.
So looking at the amount of land then is meaningless if you don't also look at what kind of control exists on the land.
Exactly. The issue is control versus sovereignty and viability. The whole assumption that 95% of the land equals 95% sovereignty is not true. And sometimes we make an analogy, I think it's a good analogy actually, to a prison. If you look at a blueprint of a prison, 95% of the area belongs to the prisoners. You know, you've got the cell areas, you have the exercise yard, you have the cafeteria, you've got the workshop areas. And all the prison authorities have is 5%. They have the walls around, they have the cell bars, they have the control things. In other words, I think that's a very good analogy, because in a sense the West Bank and Gaza have become, in our view, probably the largest jails in the world.
Salim, what does it mean in your day-to-day life as a Palestinian living with things like closure?
You know, since 1993, our situation in West Bank and Jerusalem and Gaza, it's titled as a peace process going on. But details on the ground, it's something else, as my friend Jeff said. Just since September until now, more than 350 Palestinians killed. more than 15,000 injured. You don't believe that more than 400,000 Palestinian laborers are jailed in their villages and cities. They can't go out and nobody can go into them. So I can't see any peace process in this situation. You know, our life, it's coming very, very hard that people are suffering, people are in hunger. There is no any peace process going on. It's a war going against the
Palestinians. So you have no freedom of movement around?
You know, if you want to go from the north, from Jenin to Hebron in the south, you need one day, well, you need 10 hours, and maybe you can reach your goal or you can't, because you will meet more than 20 to 25 checkpoints all over this way, Israeli.
And how far is that distance?
It's about 120 kilometers.
I don't know what the equivalent is so much in Western Canada. We figured on our trip that the West Bank is roughly the size of Prince Edward Island.
We know what that is over here. So
that it must be, in terms of Victoria Island or whatever, it must be much smaller than that. Although Prince Edward Island has about 120,000 inhabitants, and the West Bank has more than 2 million. So if you imagine taking a whole day going from one end of Prince Edward Island to the other, you get a concept of what we're talking about.
And I understand that the Knesset passed a law that no Palestinian can drive without a woman in the car?
Without a woman behind him. Imagine that you can't drive a car as a Palestinian unless you have a woman behind you.
And why?
And this is a law. Not in their imagination, not to let Palestinians shoot to the settlers or to make, fighting with settlers or shoot to them. But
it's a military order that was designed to combat drive-by shootings. The assumption being, if there's a woman in the car, it's not an aggressive ride or something, I guess. Women aren't as aggressive.
So this would mean, as a parent, you can't... You'd be leaving your children alone then if you wanted to go somewhere. You'd have to take a daughter, or you'd have to take your wife. Or
yes. You have to take somebody, which is woman behind you, that can catch you, can't do anything. But it's only the security which they are talking about all the time. I don't know who needs the security. When they came to destroy our home, more than 200 soldiers came to take out of the home 6 kids. And their mother and their father. Who needs the security? I don't know where is the balance in this formula. These 6 kids or the 200 soldiers. We are likely unweaponed in... Palestinian Authority is likely unweaponed in West Bank and Gaza. You know, in our new situation, it's a war going on by helicopters and tanks and rockets and... It is a very, very, very bad situation we are in now.
Was it this matrix of control that you talk about, Jeff, that destroyed Oslo?
Well, there's a real question here, and it's kind of a painful question, because I know many people have invested a lot of hopes in the Oslo process, the peace process. But really, if you look back at the last 7 years, and especially from the ground up, as we've been talking about, and with the idea of this matrix of control that's been ever and ever more ensconced, you really have to ask the question, was there ever a peace process? And in my view, there wasn't. I think what happened is that the Palestinians were in a very weak position, didn't have many choices in 1993. They were very isolated. The PLO was isolated. And in some ways, you could look at the Oslo process as a kind of a suing for terms of surrender, in a way. And I think Israel certainly had the idea the Palestinians are so weak that they can pretty much be dictated to. And the whole dynamic of the last 7 years has been Israel saying, okay, we're going to keep control of this area. But we want to get rid of Palestinians, because again, if we give citizenship, if we maintain control and we give citizenship to 3 million Palestinians in the occupied territories, the whole character, the Jewish character of the state is gone. If we maintain control and don't give citizenship, it's apartheid. So that the best scenario for Israel's eyes was to maintain control, but within that matrix of control, within the elements we've talked about, to give the Palestinians just enough territory and just enough kind of a minimal sovereignty that they can set up a dependent but functioning state, which would then basically relieve Israel of having to give citizenship to the Palestinians. And that's been the dynamic. But the Palestinian street, I think, in the last Intifada, the message was, no, that is not acceptable. Oslo is leading inevitably to apartheid. They put Arafat on notice not to sign the Camp David agreements because there was tremendous pressure on him to do so, and there was a fear, I think, that he might. And essentially, I think the Intifada succeeded in breaking out of Oslo, so that we're in a very new, a very dangerous situation, but I think a kind of a transitory one, in which Sharon also, from his part, has said we're at the peace process is finished. Now there's no peace process and there's no framework, and in some ways that's good, because as long as we were locked into Oslo, we were really locked into a system that was leading to apartheid because Israel was in control. The whole parameters of Oslo that the Palestinians agreed to were such that they couldn't possibly get a viable state. The issue isn't a state. The issue is a viable, truly sovereign state. That wouldn't have come out of Oslo. Now we're going to get into a time, I think, of tremendous repression. But at least the occupation is going to come back to center stage now. Nobody's pretending the peace process is still alive. The occupation will come back so that when we do get back to a process of peacemaking, I think that the essential item on the agenda, which is ending the occupation and establishing a viable and truly sovereign Palestinian state, will be at the center. And from that point of view, I think as much as these last few months have been painful, and the next few months with Sharon are going to be more painful, in a way, it's a kind of a breaking out of a framework that was not good for the Palestinians, and there's the opportunity now to try to get into a process that would be better, because I should say, really, that from my point of view, both the Israeli public and the Palestinian public want peace. And the trick is to try to find a way to get the leaders to negotiate a kind of a peace that's really good for both peoples.
Is that your perspective also on Sharon's election?
Yes, it's the same which Jeff said. But our hopes, because we are losing now, and Israelis are losing now, so we are in a lose-lose situation now. I hope that in the near future we'll have a win-win situation instead of this lose-lose situation all the time. Because really we are looking to have a good life for our kids, Israelis and Palestinians.
So despite the fact that a man has been elected who says that peace process is over, you see that as a move towards...
You know, I see that at least we are not in a peace process, and all the world will know that we are not in a peace process, so we are in occupation. Let's take this occupation off. All the world, we are asking all the world to take us off from this occupation.
And what Salim is saying is really our one of our central messages. We're looking for a win-win situation. In today's world, and in our situation in particular, no side's going to win and beat the other side. We're not going to drive the Palestinians into Jordan. They're not going to throw us into the sea. Today, as Salim says, we're in a lose-lose situation where nobody is getting anything out of this. So that our message is that we have to look at this as a win-win situation, and that's, I think, what the different publics want. Now, which means then that we have to get beyond this either-or idea, and this is really what we encounter all the time. And to be honest, we encounter it especially in the Jewish community, which is understandable. But this whole idea that if you're pro-Palestinian, you're anti-Israel. If you're pro-Israeli, you're anti-Palestinian, is simply a passe one, and it's not constructive at all. You know, we've been characterized as a poisonous anti-Israel roadshow in different literature that different right-wing Jewish groups have put out and so on. And it's really not true. I mean, in a sense, both peoples have an identical interest. And Salim often says, you know, what's good for the Palestinians is good for Israel. So we have to look at ourselves as being on the same side. We're two peoples in the same country, locked together forever. And one side is not going to beat the other side. And to the degree that one side or the other suffers, it's not good for anyone. And therefore, our message is, let's get beyond the either-or. And this anti-Israel or pro-Zionist or anti-Zionist or pro-Arab, all that ridiculous stuff that, you know, that was current 20 or 30 years ago. And let's begin to look at the common interests of all of us. And in fact, even beyond the Arab-Palestinian, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, let's begin to look at the regional issues of development and so on, in which Israel could play a key role.
So what would you like to see progressive people supporting? What framework?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think first of all, the most immediate thing is to end the occupation. That has to become like a mantra, or to paraphrase Clinton, it's the occupation, stupid. In other words, that's the basic issue. Beyond that, then, I think we have to support the emergence of a viable and truly sovereign Palestinian state, which is, in other words, a two-state solution. Now, I would see that as actually a transitory stage. I think the Palestinians need a state of their own. They need to get themselves together. They need their flag. They need to strengthen their economy and so on, and to repair some of the damage of the last 100 years or so. But I think in the end, if there's a Palestinian state and the region begins to stabilize, I think fairly quickly we're going to move towards some kind of a regional confederation, something maybe on the European Union order, because the natural geographic, cultural, economic unit of that area is really Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. And I would look forward to that kind of a regional confederation emerging in the not-too-distant future.
And I guess the right of return for Palestinian refugees is a central part of that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Unless we are asking from the Israeli government to accept our right of return, then we negotiate it. But to tell that there is no right of return for the Palestinians, it means that jumping over the fourth Geneva Convention rules, it means that, you know. So Palestinians, they have to take their right of return, then negotiate as the possibilities of life.
Thank you very much to both of you coming in this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I've been speaking with Salim Shawamre and Jeff Halper, their peace with justice activists in Palestine and Israel.
Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live, Saturdays from 9 to noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM in BC, Canada. For more information, check out www.vcn.bc.ca/redeye.